I can and I will. And he hung up. May checked her purse. She had a condom. And she stayed. She chose the far stall and waited. She knew that waiting for him was not wise, that it was wrong on many levels. She wouldn't be able to tell Annie about this. Annie would approve of most carnal activity, but not here, at work, in a bathroom. This would demonstrate poor judgment and reflect poorly on Annie. May watched the time. 2 minutes had passed, and still she was in a bathroom stall, waiting for a man she knew only vaguely and who, she guessed, wanted only to ravish her repeatedly in ever stranger places. So why was she there? Because she wanted this to happen. She wanted him to take her in the stall, and she wanted to know that she had been taken in the stall, at work, and that only the two of them would ever know. Why was this some glittering thing she needed? She heard the door open, and then the clicking of the lock on the door, a lock she didn't know existed. Then she heard the sound of Cowden's long strides. The footsteps stopped near the stalls, giving way to a dark squeaking, the strain of bolts and steel. She felt a shadow above her, and craned her neck to see a figure descending to it. Cowden had climbed the high stall wall and had crawled across the grid to get to hers. She felt him slip in behind her. The heat of his body warmed her back, his breath hot on the nape of her neck. "What are you doing?" she asked. His mouth opened on her ear, his tongue diving. She gasped and leaned into him. Cowden's hands came around her stomach, traced her waist, traveled quickly to her thighs, holding them firmly. She pushed his hands inward and up, her mind battling, and finally asserting her right to do this. She was 24, and if she did not do this kind of thing now, did not do exactly this exactly now, she never would. It was the imperative of youth. "May," he whispered, "stop thinking." "Okay. And close your eyes. Picture what I'm doing to you." His mouth was on her neck, kissing it, licking it, while his hands were busy with her skirt and panties. He eased both off her hips and to the floor, and brought her to him, filling her at once. "May," he said, as she pushed herself into him, his hands holding her hips, bringing him so deep she could feel his swollen crown somewhere near her heart. "May," he said, as she held the walls on either side of them, as if holding back the rest of the world. She came, gasping, and he finished too, shuddering, but silent. And immediately, they both laughed, quietly, knowing they'd done something reckless and career-threatening, and that they needed to leave. He turned her toward him and kissed her mouth, his eyes open, looking astounded and full of mischief. "Bye," he said, and she only waved, feeling his shape rise again behind her, climb the walls, and make his way out. And because he paused at the door to unlock it, and because she thought she might never see him again, May found her phone, reached over the stall wall, and took a picture, not knowing whether or not she would catch any semblance of him. When she looked at what she'd captured, it was only his right arm, from the elbow to his fingertips. The rest of him, already gone. Why lie to Annie? May asked herself, not knowing the answer, but knowing she would lie to her anyway. After composing herself in the bathroom, May had gone back to her desk and immediately, unable to control herself, had messaged Annie, who was flying somewhere to or over Europe. "Again with gray hair," she wrote. Telling Annie at all would precipitate a series of lies, big and small, and May found herself, in the minutes between when she sent the message and Annie's inevitable reply, wondering just how much to conceal, and why. Finally, Annie's message came. "Must know everything now. I'm in London with some Parliament lackeys. I think one just pulled out a monocle. Give me distraction." While she decided just how much to tell Annie, May teased out details. "In a bathroom?" Annie replied immediately. "The old man? In a bathroom? Did you use the diaper-changing station?" "No, in a stall. And he was vigorous." A voice behind May said her name. May turned to find Gina and her enormous, nervous smile. You have a second? May attempted to turn away the screen containing the dialogue with Annie, but Gina had already seen it. You're talking to Annie? She said. You guys really are tight, huh? May nodded, turned her screen, and all light left Gina's face. Is this still a good time to explain conversion rate in retail raw? May had forgotten entirely that Gina was supposed to come to demonstrate a new layer. Sure, May said. Has Annie told you about this stuff already? Gina said, her face looking very fragile. No, May said. She hasn't. She didn't tell you about conversion rate? No. Or retail raw? No. Gina's face brightened. Oh, okay. Good. So we'll do it now. Gina's face searched May's as if looking for the slightest sign of doubt, which Gina would take as reason to collapse entirely. Great, May said, and Gina brightened again. Good. Let's start with the conversion rate. This is fairly obvious anyway, but the circle would not exist and would not grow and would not be able to get closer to completing the circle if there were not actual purchases being made, actual commerce spurred. We're here to be a gateway to all the world's information, but we are supported by advertisers who hope to reach customers through us, right? Gina smiled, her large white teeth briefly overtaking her face. May was trying to concentrate, but she was thinking of Annie in her parliament meeting, who was no doubt thinking of May and Calden. And when May thought of herself and Calden, she thought of his hands on her waist, pulling her gently down onto him, her eyes closed, her mind enlarging all. Gina was still talking. But how to provoke, how to stimulate purchases, that's the conversion rate. You can zing, you could comment on and rate and highlight any product, but can you translate all this into action? Leveraging your credibility to spur action, this is crucial, okay? Now Gina was sitting next to May, her fingers on her keyboard. She brought up a complex spreadsheet. At that moment, another message from Annie arrived on May's second screen. She turned it slightly. Now I have to be the boss. You got his last name this time? May saw that Gina was reading the message, too, making no pretense of doing otherwise. Go ahead, Gina said. That looks important. May reached over Gina to her keyboard and typed the lie she knew moments after leaving the bathroom she would tell Annie. Yes, I know all. Immediately, Annie's reply arrived. And his name is? Gina looked at this message. That must be so crazy to just get messages from Annie Allerton. I guess so, May said, and typed, can't tell. Gina read May's message and seemed less interested in the content of it than the fact that this back and forth was actually happening in front of her. You guys just message each other like it's no big deal? She asked. May softened the impact. Not all day. Not all day? Gina's face came alive with a tentative smile. Annie burst through. You're actually not telling me? Tell me now. Sorry, May said. Almost done. She typed, no, you'll hassle him. Send me a picture, Annie wrote. No, but I have one, May typed, executing the second lie she knew was necessary. She did have a photo of him, and once she realized she did, and that she could tell Annie this, and be telling the truth without telling all of it, and that this photo, along with the white lie of knowing his actual last name, would allow her to continue with this man, Calden, who very well might be a danger to the circle, she knew she would use this second lie with Annie, and it would buy her more time to rise and fall on Calden, while trying to ascertain exactly who he was and what he wanted from her. An action shot, she typed. I did a facial rec, and it all connects. Thank God, Annie wrote. But you're a bitch. Gina, who had read the message, was visibly flustered. Maybe we should do this later, she said, her forehead suddenly glistening. No, sorry, May said. Go on, I'll turn the screen away. Another message appeared from Annie. While turning the screen away, May glanced at it. Did you hear the fracturing of any bones while sitting on him? Older men have bird bones, and pressure like you're talking about could be fatal. Okay, Gina said, swallowing hard. For years, lesser companies had been tracking and trying to influence the connection between online mentions, reviews, comments, ratings, and actual purchases. Circle developers have figured out a way to measure the impact of these factors, of your participation, really, and articulate it with the conversion rate. Another message appeared, but May ignored it, and Gina forged on, thrilled to have been deemed more important than Annie, even for a moment. So every purchase initiated or prompted by a recommendation you make raises your conversion rate. If your purchase or recommendation spurs 50 others to take the same action, then your CR is times 50. There are circlers with a conversion rate of times 1,200. That means an average of 1,200 people buy whatever they buy. They've accumulated enough credibility that their followers trust their recommendations implicitly and are deeply thankful for the surety in their shopping. Annie, of course, has one of the highest CRs in the circle. Just then, another droplet sounded. Gina blinked as if she'd been slapped, but continued. Okay, so your average conversion rate so far has been times 119. Not bad, but on a scale of 1 to 1,000, there's a lot of room for improvement. Below the conversion rate is your retail raw, the total gross purchase price of recommended products. So let's say you recommend a certain keychain, and 1,000 people take your recommendation. Then those 1,000 keychains, priced at $4 each, bring your retail raw to $4,000. It's just the gross retail price of the commerce you've stoked. Fun, right? May nodded. She loved the notion of actually being able to track the effect of her tastes and endorsements. Another droplet sounded. Gina seemed to be blinking back tears. She stood up. Okay, I feel like I'm invading your lunch and your friendship, so that's a conversion rate in retail raw. I know you understand it. There'll be a new screen by the end of the day to measure these scores. Gina tried to smile, but couldn't seem to lift the sides of her mouth enough to seem convincing. Oh, and the minimum expectation for high-functioning circlers is a conversion rate of times 250 and a weekly retail raw of $45,000, both of which are modest goals that most circlers far exceed. And if you have questions, well, she stopped, her eyes fragile. I'm sure you can ask Annie. She turned and left. A few nights later, on a cloudless Thursday, May drove home, her first time since her father's circle insurance had taken effect. She knew her father had been feeling far better, and she was looking forward to seeing him in person, hoping, ridiculously, for some miraculous change, but knowing she would see only minor improvements.
Still, her parents' voices on the phone and in texts had been ebullient.
Everything's different now, they'd been saying for weeks, and had been asking to have her come celebrate. And so, looking forward to the imminent gratitude, she drove east and south, and when she arrived, her father greeted her at the door, looking far stronger and, more importantly, more confident, more like a man, the man he once was. He held out his wrist monitor and arranged it parallel to May's.
Look at us. We match. You want some vino?
Inside, the three of them arranged themselves as they always had, along the kitchen counter, and they diced and breaded, and they talked about the various ways the health of May's father had improved. Now he had his choice of doctors. Now he had no limitations on the medicines he could take. They were all covered, and there was no copay. May noticed, as they narrated the story of his recent health, that her mother was brighter, more buoyant. She was wearing short shorts.
The best thing about it, her father said, is that now your mother has whole swaths of extra time. It's all so simple. I see the doctor and the circle takes care of the rest. No middleman, no discussion.
Is that what I think it is? May said. Over the dining room table, there was a silver chandelier, though upon closer inspection, it seemed like one of Mercer's. The silver arms were actually painted antlers. May had been only passingly enthusiastic about any of his work. When they were dating, she labored for kind things to say. But this one, she genuinely liked.
It is, her mother said. Not bad, May said.
Not bad, her father said. It's his best work, and you know it. This thing would go for $5,000 in one of those San Francisco boutiques. He gave it to us for free.
May was impressed. Why for free?
Why for free? Her mother asked.
Because he's our friend. Because he's a nice young man. And wait before you roll your eyes or come back with some witty comment. May did wait, and after she'd passed on a half-dozen unkind things she could say about Mercer and had chosen silence, she found herself feeling generous toward him. Because she no longer needed him, because she was now a crucial and measurable driver of world commerce, and because she had two men at the circle to choose from, one of them a volcanic, calligraphic enigma who climbed walls to take her from behind. She could afford to be generous toward poor Mercer, his shaggy head and grotesque fatty back.
"It's really nice," May said. "Glad you think so," her mother said. "You can tell him yourself in a few minutes. He's coming for dinner."
"No," May said.
"Please, no."
"May," her father said firmly, "he's coming, okay?"
And she knew she couldn't argue. Instead, she poured herself a glass of red wine and, while setting the table, she downed half of it. By the time Mercer knocked and let himself in, her face was half numb and her thoughts were vague.
"Hey, May,"
he said, and gave her a tentative hug.
"Your chandelier thing is really great," she said, and even while saying the words, she saw their effect on him, so she went further. "It's really beautiful."
"Thanks," he said.
He looked around to May's parents as if confirming they had heard the same thing. May poured herself more wine.
"It really is," May continued. "I mean, I know you do good work."
And when she said this, May made sure not to look at him, knowing his eyes would doubt her.
"But this is the best one you've done yet. I'm so happy that you put this much into... I'm just happy that my favorite piece of yours is in my parents' dining room."
May took out her camera and took a picture.
"What are you doing?"
Mercer said, though he seemed pleased that she deemed it worthy of a photograph.
"I just wanted to take a picture. Look,"
she said, and showed him. Now her parents had disappeared, no doubt thinking she wanted time alone with Mercer. They were hilarious and insane.
"It looks good," he said,
staring at the photo a bit longer than May had expected. He was not, evidently, above taking pleasure and pride in his own work.
"It looks incredible," she said. The wine had sent her aloft. "That was very nice of you, and I know it means a lot to them, especially now. It had something very important here."
May was euphoric, and it wasn't just the wine. It was release. Her family had been released.
"This place has been so dark," she said.
And for a brief moment, she and Mercer seemed to find their former footing. May, who for years had thought about Mercer with a disappointment bordering on pity, remembered now that he was capable of great work. She knew he was compassionate and very kind, even though his limited horizons had been exasperating. But now, seeing this, could she call it artwork? It was something like art, and the effect it had on the house, her faith in him was rekindled. "That gave me an idea." Under the pretense that she was going to her room to change, she excused herself and hurried upstairs. But instead, sitting on her old bed, in 3 minutes, she'd posted her photo of the chandelier in 2 dozen design and home design feeds, linking to Mercer's website, which featured just his phone number and a few pictures. He hadn't updated it in years, and his email address. If he wasn't smart enough to get business for himself, she would be happy to do it for him. When she was finished, Mercer was sitting with her parents at the kitchen table, which was crowded with salad and stir-fried chicken and vegetables. Their eyes followed her down the stairs.
"I called up there," her father said.
"We like to eat when it's hot," her mother added.
May hadn't heard them.
"Sorry, I was just... Wow, this looks good. Dad, don't you think Mercer's chandelier is awesome?"
"I do, and I told you, and him as much. We've been asking for one of his creations for a year now."
"I just needed the right antlers," Mercer said.
"I hadn't gotten any really great ones in a while."
He went on to explain his sourcing, how he bought antlers only from trusted collaborators, people he knew hadn't hunted the deer, or, if they had been instructed to do so by Fish and Game to curb overcrowding.
"That is fascinating," her mother said. "Before I forget, I want to raise a toast."
"What's that?"
May's phone had beeped.
"Nothing," she said.
But in a second, I think I'll have some good news to announce. Go on, Mom. I was just saying that I wanted to toast having us...
Now it was Mercer's phone ringing. Sorry, he said, and maneuvered his hand outside his pants, finding the off button.
Everyone done? Her mother asked.
Sorry, Mrs. Holland, Mercer said. Go on.
But at that moment, May's phone buzzed loudly again, and when May looked to its screen, she saw that there were 37 new zings in messages.
Something you have to attend to? Her father said.
No, not yet,
May said, though she was almost too excited to wait. She was proud of Mercer, and soon she'd be able to show him something about the audience he might have outside Longfield. If there were 37 messages in the first few minutes, in 20 minutes there would be 100.
Her mother continued.
I was going to thank you, May, for all you've done to improve your father's health and my own sanity, and I wanted to toast Mercer, too, as part of our family, and to thank him for his beautiful work.
She paused, as if expecting a buzz to sound any moment.
Well, I'm just glad I got through that. Let's eat. The food's getting cold.
And they began to eat. But after a few minutes, May had heard so many dings, and she'd seen her phone screen update so many times, that she couldn't wait.
Okay, I can't stand it anymore. I posted that photo I took of your chandelier, Mercer, and people love it.
She beamed and raised her glass.
That's what we should toast.
Mercer didn't look amused. Wait, you posted them where?
That's great, Mercer,
her father said, and raised his own glass. Mercer's glass was not raised.
Where'd you post them, May?
Everywhere relevant, she said. And the comments are amazing. She searched her screen. Just let me read the first one. And I quote, Wow, that is gorgeous. That's from a pretty well-known industrial designer in Stockholm. Here's another one. Very cool. Reminds me of something I saw in Barcelona last year. That was from a designer in Santa Fe who has her own shop. She gave your thing 3 out of 4 stars and had some suggestions about how you might improve it. I bet you could sell them there if you wanted to. So here's another.
Mercer had his palms on the table.
Stop, please.
Why? You haven't even heard the best part. On Design Mind, you already have 122 smiles. That's an incredible amount to get so quickly. And they have a ranking there, and you're in the top 50 for today. Actually, I know how you could raise that.
At the same time, it occurred to May that this kind of activity would surely get her party rank into the 1800s, and if she could get enough of these people to buy the work, it would mean solid conversion and retail raw numbers.
May, stop. Please stop.
Mercer was staring at her, his eyes small and round.
I don't want to get loud here in your parents' home, but either you stop, or I have to walk out.
Just hold on a sec, she said, and scrolled through her messages. Looking for one that she was sure would impress him, she'd seen a message come in from Dubai, and if she found it, she knew his resistance would fall away.
May, she heard her mother say.
May.
But May couldn't locate the message. Where was it? While she scrolled, she heard the scraping of a chair, but she was so close to finding it that she didn't look up. When she did, she found Mercer gone, and her parents staring at her.
I think it's nice you want to support Mercer, her mother said. But I just don't understand why you do this now. We're trying to enjoy a nice dinner.
May stared at her mother, absorbing all the disappointment and bewilderment that she could stand, then ran outside and reached Mercer as he was backing out of the driveway. She got into the passenger seat.
Stop.
His eyes were dull, lifeless. He put the car in park and rested his hands in his lap, exhaling with all the condescension he could muster.
What the hell is your problem, Mercer?
May, I asked you to stop, and you didn't.
Did I hurt your feelings?
No, you hurt my brain. You make me think you're batshit crazy. I asked you to stop, and you wouldn't.
I wouldn't stop trying to help you.
I didn't ask for your help, and I didn't give you permission to post a photo of my work.
Your work?
She heard something barbed in her voice that she knew wasn't right or productive.
You're snide, May. And you're mean, and you're callous.
What? I'm the opposite of callous, Mercer. I'm trying to help you because I believe in what you do.
No, you don't. May,
You're just unable to allow anything to live inside a room. My work exists in one room. It doesn't exist anywhere else, and that's how I intend it.
So you don't want business?
Mercer looked through his windshield, then leaned back. May? I've never felt more that there was some cult taking over the world. You know what someone tried to sell me the other day? Actually, I bet it's somehow affiliated with the Circle. Have you heard of Homie? The thing where your phone scans your house for the barcodes of every product? Right, then it orders new stuff whenever you're getting low. It's brilliant.
You think this is okay?
Mercer said. You know how they framed it for me? It's a usual utopian vision. This time, they were saying it'll reduce waste. If stores know what their customers want, then they don't overproduce, don't overship, don't have to throw stuff away when it's not bought. I mean, like everything else you guys are pushing, it sounds perfect, sounds progressive, but it carries with it more control, more central tracking of everything we do.
Mercer, the Circle is a group of people like me. Are you saying that somehow we're all in a room somewhere watching you, planning world domination?
No, first of all, I know it's all people like you, and that's what's so scary. Individually, you don't know what you're doing collectively. But secondly, don't presume the benevolence of your leaders. For years, there was this happy time when those controlling the major internet conduits were actually decent enough people, or at least they weren't predatory and vengeful. But I always worried, what if someone was willing to use this power to punish those who challenged them?
What are you saying?
You think it's just a coincidence that every time some congresswoman or blogger talks about monopoly, they suddenly become ensnared in some terrible sex porn witchcraft controversy? For 20 years, the internet was capable of ruining anyone in minutes. But not until your three wise men, or at least one of them, was anyone willing to do it. You're saying this is news to you?
You're so paranoid. Your conspiracy theory brain always depressed me, Mercer. You sound so ignorant, and saying that Homie is some scary new thing, I mean, for 100 years there were milkmen who brought you milk. They knew when you needed it. There were butchers who sold you meat, bakers who would drop off bread, but the milkman wasn't scanning my house. I mean, anything with a UPC code can be scanned. Already, millions of people's phones are scanning their homes and communicating all that information out to the world. And so what? You don't want Charmin to know how much of their toilet paper you're using? Is Charmin oppressing you in some significant way?
No, mate, it's different. That would be easier to understand. Here, though, there are no oppressors. No one's forcing you to do this. You willingly tie yourself to these leashes, and you willingly become utterly socially autistic. You no longer pick up on basic human communication clues. You're at a table with three humans, all of whom are looking at you and trying to talk to you, and you're staring at a screen, searching for strangers in Dubai.
You're not so pure, Mercer. You have an email account. You have a website.
Here's the thing, and it's painful to say this to you, but you're not very interesting anymore. You sit at a desk 12 hours a day, and you have nothing to show for it except for some numbers that won't exist or be remembered in a week. You're leaving no evidence that you lived. There's no proof.
Fuck you, Mercer.
And worse, you're not doing anything interesting anymore. You're not seeing anything, saying anything. The weird paradox is that you think you're at the center of things, and that makes your opinions more valuable, but you yourself are becoming less vibrant. I bet you haven't done anything off-screen in months, have you?
You're such a fucker, Mercer.
Do you go outside anymore?
You're the interesting one, is that it? The idiot who makes chandeliers out of dead animal parts? You're the wonder boy of all that's fascinating?
You know what I think, May? I think you think that sitting at your desk, frowning and smiling, somehow makes you think you're actually living some fascinating life. You comment on things, and that substitutes for doing them. You look at pictures of Nepal, push a smile button, and you think that's the same as going there. I mean, what would happen if you actually went? Your circle jerk ratings or whatever the fuck would drop below an acceptable level? May, do you realize how incredibly boring you've become?
For many years now, Mercer had been the human she'd loathed more than any other. This was not new. He'd always had the unique ability to send her into apoplexy, his professional smugness, his antiquarian bullshit, and most of all, his baseline assumption, so wrong, that he knew her. He knew the parts of her he liked and agreed with, and he pretended those were her true self, her essence. He knew nothing. But with every passing mile as she drove home, she felt better. Better with every mile between her and that fat fuck. The fact that she'd ever slept with him made her physically sick. Had she been possessed by some weird demon?
Her body must have been overtaken for those 3 years by some terrible force that blinded her to his wretchedness. He'd been fat even then, hadn't he? What kind of guy is fat in high school? He's talking to me about sitting behind a desk when he's 40 pounds overweight? The man was upside down. She would not talk to him again. She knew this, and there was comfort in that. Relief spread over her like warm water. She would never talk to him, write to him. She would insist that her parents sever any connection to him. She planned to destroy the chandelier, too. It would look like an accident. Maybe stage a break-in? May laughed to herself, thinking of exorcising that fat idiot from her life, that ugly, ever-sweating moose man who would never have a say in her world again. She saw the sign for Maiden's Voyages and thought nothing of it. She passed the exit and didn't feel a thing. Seconds later, though, she was leaving the highway and doubling back toward the beach. It was almost 10 o'clock, so she knew the shop had been closed for hours. So what was she doing? She wasn't reacting to Mercer's bullshit questions about what she was or wasn't doing outside. She was only seeing if the place was open. She knew it wouldn't be, but maybe Marion was there, and maybe she'd let May take one out for half an hour. She lived in the trailer next door, after all. Maybe May could catch her walking within the compound and be able to persuade her to rent her one. May parked and peered through the chain-link fence, seeing no one, only the shuttered rental kiosk, the rows of kayaks and paddle boards. She stood, hoping to see a silhouette within the trailer, but there was none. The light within was dim, rose-colored, the trailer empty. She walked to the tiny beach and stood, watching the moonlight play on the still surface of the bay. She sat. She didn't want to go home, though there was no point in staying. Her head was full of Mercer and his giant infant's face and all the bullshit things he had said that night, and said every night. That would be, she was certain, the last time she tried to help him in any way. He was in her past, in the past. He was an antique, a dull, inanimate object she could leave in an attic. She stood up, thinking she should go back to work on her party rank, when she saw something odd. Against the far side of the fence, outside the enclosure, she saw a large object leaning precariously. It was either a kayak or a paddleboard, and she quickly made her way to it. It was a kayak, she realized, and it was resting on the free side of the fence, a paddle next to it. The positioning of the kayak made little sense. She'd never seen one standing nearly upright before and was sure that Marion wouldn't have approved. May could only think that someone had brought a rental back after closing and tried to get it as close to the enclosure as possible. May thought at the very least she should bring the kayak to the ground to reduce the chances that it would fall overnight. She did so, carefully lowering it to the sand, surprised by how light it was. Then she had a thought. The water was just 30 yards away, and she knew that she could easily drag it to shore. Would it be theft to borrow a kayak that had already been borrowed? She wasn't lifting it over the fence, after all. She was only extending the borrowing that someone else had extended. She would return it in an hour or two, and no one would know the difference. May put the paddle inside and dragged the kayak across the sand for a few feet, testing the feeling of this act. Was it theft? Certainly Marion would understand if she knew. Marion was a free spirit, not a rule-bound shrew, and seemed like the type of person who, in May's shoes, would do the same thing. She would not like the liability implications, but then again, were there such implications? How could Marion be held accountable if the kayak was taken without her knowledge? Now May was at the shore, and the bow of the kayak was wet. And then, feeling the water under the vessel, the way the current seemed to pull the kayak out from her and into the fuller volume of the bay, May knew that she would do this. The one complication was that she wouldn't have a life preserver. It was the one thing the borrower managed to heave over the fence. But the water was so calm that May saw no possibility of real danger if she stayed close to the shore. Once she was out on the water, though, feeling the heavy glass under her, the quick progress she was making, she thought she might not stay in the shallows, that this would be the night to make it to Blue Island. Angel Island was easy. People went there all the time. But Blue Island was strange, jagged, never visited. May smiled, picturing herself there, and smiled wider, thinking of Mercer, his smug face, surprised, upended. Mercer would be too fat to fit into a kayak, she thought, and too lazy to make it out of the marina. A man, fast approaching 30, making antler chandeliers and lecturing her? Who worked at the Circle? About life paths? This was a joke. But May, who was in the T2K and who was moving quickly up through the ranks, was also brave, capable of taking a kayak in the night into the Blackwater Bay to explore an island Mercer would only view through a telescope, sitting on his potato sack ass, painting animal parts with silver paint. Hers was not an itinerary rooted in any logic. She had no idea of the currents deeper in the bay, or of the wisdom in getting so close to the tankers that used the nearby shipping lane, especially given she would be in the dark, invisible to them. And by the time she reached or got close to the island, the conditions might be too rough for her to go back. But driven by a force within her as strong and reflexive as sleep, she knew she would not stop until she made it to Blue Island, or was somehow prevented from doing so. If the wind kept quiet and the water held steady, she would make it there. As she paddled beyond the sailboats and breakers, she looked south, squinting in search of the barge where the woman and man lived. But the shapes that far away were not clear, and anyway, they were unlikely to have lights on this late. She stayed on course, cutting quickly beyond the anchored yachts and into the round stomach of the bay. She heard a quick splash behind her and turned to find the black head of a harbor seal, not 15 feet away. She waited for him to drop below the surface, but he stayed, staring at her. She turned back and paddled again toward the island, and the seal followed her for a bit, as if also wanting to see what she wanted to see. May wondered, briefly, if the seal would follow her all the way, or if he was, perhaps, on his way to the group of rocks near the island, where many times, driving on the bridge overhead, she'd seen seals sunning. But the next time she turned around, the animal was gone. The water's surface remained calm, even as she ventured deeper. Where it usually turned rough, where the water was exposed to ocean winds, it was, this night, utterly placid, and her progress remained swift. In 20 minutes, she was halfway to the island, or it appeared that way. The distances were impossible to tell, especially at night, but the island was growing in her vision, and features of the rock she'd never grasped before were now visible. She saw something reflective at the top, the moonlight casting it in bright silver. She saw the remains of what she was sure was a window resting on the black sand of the shore. Far away, she heard a foghorn coming from the mouth of the Golden Gate. The fog must be thick there, she thought. Even while where she was, only a few miles away, the night was clear, the moon brilliant and nearly whole. Its shimmer on the water was outlandish, so bright she found herself squinting. She wondered about the rocks near the island where she'd seen seals and sea lions. Would they be there? And would they flee before her arrival? A breeze came from the west, a Pacific wind swooping down off the hills, and she sat still for a moment, measuring it. If it picked up, she would have to turn back. She was now closer to the island than the shore, but if the water grew choppy, the danger, alone and without a life preserver, sitting atop a kayak, would be untenable. But, as quickly as it had come, the wind disappeared. A loud murmuring sound brought her attention to the north. A boat, something like a tug, was coming toward her. On the roof of the cabin she saw lights, white and red, and knew it was a patrol of some kind, Coast Guard probably, and they were close enough to see her. If she remained upright, her silhouette would quickly give her away. She flattened herself against the floor of the kayak, hoping that if they saw the shape she was making, they would assume it was a rock, a log, a seal, or simply a wide black ripple interrupting the bay's silver shimmer. The groan of the boat's engine grew louder, and May was sure there would soon be some bright flood upon her. But the boat passed quickly, and May went unseen. The last push to the island was so quick, May questioned her sense of distance. One moment she felt she was halfway there at best, and the next she was racing toward the island's beach as if propelled by heavy tailwinds. She jumped from the bow, the water white cold and seizing her. She rushed to get the kayak on shore, dragging it up until it was entirely out of the water and onto the sand. Remembering the time when a quickly rising tide nearly took her vessel away, she turned it parallel to the shore and placed large stones on either side. She stood, breathing heavily, feeling strong, feeling enormous. What a strange thing, she thought, to be here. There was a bridge nearby, and while driving over it, she'd seen this island 100 times and had never seen a soul, human or animal. No one dared or bothered. What was it about her that made her this curious? It occurred to her that this was the only, or at least the best, way to come here. Marion would not have wanted her to go this far and might have sent a speedboat to find her and bring her back. And the Coast Guard, didn't they routinely dissuade people from coming here? Was it a private island? All of these questions and concerns were irrelevant now, because it was dark, no one could see her, and no one would ever know she was here. But she would know. She walked the perimeter. The beach collared most of the southern side of the island, then gave way to a sheer cliff. She looked up, seeing no footholds, and below was the frothy shore, so she returned the way she came, finding the hillside rough and rocky, and the shore largely unremarkable. There was a thick stripe of seaweed with crab shells and flotsam embedded, and she threaded her fingers through it. The moonlight gave the seaweed some of the phosphorescence she'd seen before, adding a rainbow sheen, as if lit from within. For a brief moment, she felt like she was on some body of water on the moon itself, everything cast in a strange, inverted palette. What should have been green looked gray. What should have been blue was silver. Everything she was seeing, she'd never seen before. And just as she had this thought, out of the corner of her eye, dropping over the Pacific, she saw what she was sure was a shooting star. She'd only seen one before, and couldn't be sure what she saw was the same thing, an arc of light disappearing behind the black hills. But what else could it be? She sat for a moment on the beach, staring into the same spot where she'd seen it, as if there might be another, or that it might give way to a shower. But she was, she knew, putting off what she wanted most to do, to climb the short peak of the rock, which now she set herself upon. There was no path, a fact that gave her great pleasure. No one, or almost no one, had ever been where she was, and so she climbed using tufts of grass and roots for handholds, and placed her feet upon the occasional rock outcroppings. She stopped once, having found a large hole, almost round, almost tidy, in the hillside. It had to be an animal's home, but what sort, she couldn't be sure. She imagined the burrows of rabbits and foxes, snakes and moles and mice, any of them equally possible and impossible here. And then she continued, up and up. It was not difficult. She was at the peak in minutes, joining a lone pine not much bigger than herself. She stood next to it, using its rough trunk for balance, and turned around. She saw the tiny white windows of the city far beyond. She watched the progress of a tanker, low-slung and carrying a constellation of red lights, into the Pacific. The beach suddenly seemed so far beneath her, and her stomach somersaulted. She looked east, now getting a better view of the seals' group of rocks, and saw a dozen or so of them lying about, sleeping. She looked up to the bridge above, not the Golden Gate, but a lesser one, its liquid white stream of cars still constant at midnight, and wondered if anyone could see her human silhouette against the silver bay. She remembered what Francis had once said, that he'd never known there was an island beneath the bridge at all. Most of the drivers and their passengers would not be looking down at her, would not have the faintest idea of her existence. Then, still holding the pine's bony trunk, she noticed, for the first time, a nest, resting in the tree's upper boughs. She didn't dare touch it, knowing she would upset its equilibrium of sense and construction, but she badly wanted to see what was inside. She stood on a stone, trying to get above it, to look down into it, but she couldn't position herself high enough to get any perspective. Could she lift it, bring it down to her, to peek in? Just for a second. She could, couldn't she, and then put it right back? No, she knew enough to know she couldn't. If she did, she'd ruin whatever was inside. She sat down, facing south, where she could see the lights, the bridges, the black, empty hills dividing the bay from the Pacific. All this had been underwater some millions of years ago, she'd been told. All these headlands and islands had been so far under, they would have barely registered as ridges on the ocean floor. Across the silver bay, she saw a pair of birds, egrets or herons, gliding low, heading north, and she sat for a time, her mind drifting toward blank. She thought of the foxes that might be underneath her, the crabs that might be hiding under the stones on the shore, the people in the cars that might be passing overhead, the men and women in the tugs and tankers, arriving to port or leaving, sighing, everyone having seen everything. She guessed at it all, what might live, moving purposefully or drifting aimlessly under the deep water around her. But she didn't think too much about any of it. It was enough to be aware of the million permutations possible around her, and take comfort in knowing she would not, and really could not, know much at all. When May arrived back at Marion's beach, it looked at first just as she'd left it. There were no people visible, and the light within Marion's trailer was as it was before, rose-colored and dim. May jumped to the shore, her feet shushing deep into the wet sand, and she dragged the kayak up the beach. Her legs were sore, and she stopped, dropped the kayak, and stretched. With her hands over her head, she looked toward the parking lot, seeing her car. But now there was another car next to it. And as she was regarding this second car, wondering if Marion was back, May was blinded by white light.
"Stay there!"
an amplified voice roared. She turned instinctively away. The amplified voice came again.
"Don't move!"
it said, now with venom. May froze there, off balance, worrying briefly about how long she could maintain such a pose. But there was no need. Two shadows descended upon her, grabbed roughly at her arms, and handcuffed her hands behind her. May sat in the back of the squad car, and the officers, calmer now, weighed whether or not what May was telling them, that she was a regular renter, had a membership, and was merely late in returning a rental, could be the truth. They had reached Marion on the phone, and she corroborated that May was a customer, but when they had asked if May had rented that day and was just tardy, Marion had hung up and said she'd be right over. 20 minutes later, Marion arrived. She was in the passenger seat of a vintage red pickup truck, the driver, a bearded man who appeared bewildered and annoyed. May, seeing Marion walk unsteadily to the police car, realized she had been drinking, and possibly the bearded man had too. He was still in the car, and seemed determined to stay there. As Marion made her way to the car, May caught her eye, and Marion, seeing May in the back of a squad car, her arms cuffed behind her, seemed to sober instantly.
"Oh, Jesus Christ!"
she said, rushing to May. She turned to the officers.
"This is May Holland. She rents here all the time. She has the run of the place. How the hell did this happen? What's going on here?"
The officers explained that they'd gotten two separate messages about a probable theft.
"We got one call from a citizen who doesn't wish to be identified."
And then they turned to Marion.
"And the other warning came from one of your own cameras, Ms. Lefebvre."
May barely slept. Her adrenaline kept her pacing through the night. How could she be so stupid? She wasn't a thief. What if Marion hadn't saved her? She could have lost everything. Her parents would have been called to bail her out, and her position at the Circle would be lost. May had never gotten a speeding ticket and never been in trouble at any level, and now she was stealing a $1,000 kayak? But it was over, and Marion had even insisted, when they parted, that May come back.
"I know you'll be embarrassed, but I want you to come back here. I will hound you if you don't."
She knew May would be so sorry and full of shame that she wouldn't want to face Marion again. Still, when she woke after a few hours of fitful sleep, May felt a strange sense of liberation, as if she'd woken up from a nightmare to know it hadn't happened. The slate was blank, and she went to work. She logged on at 8:30. Her rank was 3,892. She worked through the morning, feeling the extraordinary focus possible for a few hours after a largely sleepless night. Periodically, memories from the night before came to her. The silent silver of the water, the lone pine on the island, the blinding light of the squad car, its plastic smell, the idiotic conversation with Mercer. But these memories were fading, or she was forcing them to fade, when she received a second screen message from Dan.
"Please come to my office ASAP. Jared will cover for you."
She rushed there, and when she got to his door, Dan was standing, ready. His face seemed to show some satisfaction that she'd hurried. Dan closed the door, and they sat down.
"May, do you know what I want to talk about?"
Was this a test to see if she would lie?
"I'm sorry, I don't,"
she tried. Dan blinked slowly. "May, last chance."
"Is it about last night?"
she said. If he didn't know about the police, she could make something else up, something else that had happened after hours.
"It is."
"May, this is very serious stuff."
He knew. God, he knew. in some recess of her mind, May realized that the Circle must have some web alert to notify them anytime a staff member was charged or questioned by the police. It only made sense. But there were no charges, she protested. Marion cleared everything up.
Marion is the owner of the shop?
Yes. But May, you and I know there was a crime committed, don't we? May had no idea what to say.
May, I'll spare you. Did you know that a member of the Circle, Gary Katz, had placed a sea change camera at that beach?
Her stomach dropped into her shoe. No, I didn't.
And the owner's son, Walt, had set one up too?
No.
Okay, first of all, that's troubling in and of itself. You go kayaking sometimes, yes? I see on your profile that you're a kayaker. Josiah and Denise say you had a good talk about this.
I do go sometimes. It's been a few months.
But you've never thought to check sea change to see about water conditions?
No, I should, but every time I go, it's really a spur-of-the-moment thing. The beach is on my way home from my parents' house, so...
And you were at your parents' house yesterday?
Dan said, in a way that made clear that if she said yes, he would be even angrier.
I was, just for dinner.
Dan stood now and turned from May. She could hear his breathing, a series of exasperated bursts. May had the distinct sensation she would be fired any moment. Then she remembered Annie. Could Annie save her? Not this time.
Okay, Dan said. So you go home, missing any number of activities here, and when you drive back this way, you stop by the rental shop after hours. Don't tell me you didn't know they were closed.
I figured they were, but I just stopped to make sure.
And when you saw a kayak outside the fence, you just decided to take it.
Borrow it. I'm a member there.
Have you seen the footage of this?
Dan asked. He turned on his wall screen. May saw a clear, moonlight image of the beach from a wide-angle camera. The log line at the bottom of the screen indicated it had been taken at 10:14 p.m.
Don't you think a camera like this would be useful to you? Dan asked. Water conditions at the very least?
He didn't wait for a response.
Let's see you here.
He fast-forwarded a few seconds, and May saw her shadowy figure appear on the beach. Everything was very clear, her surprise at finding the kayak, her moments of deliberation and doubt, then her quick work of bringing the vessel to the water and paddling out of view.
Okay, Dan said. As you can see, it's pretty obvious you knew you were doing something wrong. This is not the behavior of someone with a standing arrangement with Marge or whomever. I mean, I'm happy that you two colluded on your story and that you weren't arrested, because that would have made your working here impossible. Felons don't work at the Circle. But still, all of this makes me frankly sick to my stomach. Lies and aversions, it's just astounding to even have to deal with this.
Again, May had the distinct feeling, a vibration in the air that said she was being fired.
But if she was being fired, Dan wouldn't have spent this kind of time with her, would he? And would he fire someone Annie, who was far higher on the ladder, had hired?
If she were to hear about her termination from anyone, it would be Annie herself. So May sat, hoping this was going somewhere else.
Now, what's missing here?
He asked, pointing to the frozen image of May getting into the kayak.
I don't know.
You really don't know?
Permission to use the kayak?
Sure, he said curtly.
But what else?
May shook her head.
I'm sorry, I don't know.
Don't you usually wear a life preserver?
I do, but they were on the other side of the fence.
And if something happened to you out there, God forbid, how would your parents feel?
How would Marge feel?
Marion.
How would she feel, May?
Overnight, her business is over, finished. All the people who work for her, they're all out of work. The beach is shut down, kayaking in the bay, as a business overall, goes through the floor, all because of your carelessness. Forgive me for the bluntness, but because of your selfishness.
I know, May said, feeling the sting of truth. She had been selfish. She hadn't thought of anything but her own desire. It's sad, because you've been improving so much. Your party rank was as high as 1668. Your conversion rate and retail raw were in the top quartile, and now this.
Dan sighed elaborately.
But as upsetting as this all is, it provides us with a teachable moment. And I mean a teachable moment on a life-changing level.
This shameful episode has given you the chance to meet Eamon Bailey himself.
May's gasp was audible.
Yes, he took an interest in this, seeing how much it overlaps with his interests and the overall goals of the Circle. Would you be interested in speaking to Eamon about this?
Yes, May managed. Of course.
Good. He's anxious to meet you. At 6 this evening, you'll be brought to his office. Please collect your thoughts in the meantime.
May's head echoed with self-denunciations. She hated who she was. How could she have done that? Risked her job? Embarrassed her best friend? Jeopardized her father's health insurance? She was an imbecile, yes, but was she some sort of schizophrenic, too? What had overtaken her the night before? What sort of person does that?
Her mind argued with itself while she worked, feverishly, trying to do something visible to demonstrate her commitment to the company. She handled 140 customer queries, her record so far, while answering 1,129 survey questions and while keeping the newbies on target. The pod aggregate score was 98, which she took pride in even while knowing there was some luck and some of Jared's involvement, too. He knew what was happening with May and had pledged his help. At 5 p.m., the shoot closed and May worked on her party rank for 45 minutes, bringing it from 1,827 to 1,430, a process entailing 344 comments, posts, and almost 1,000 smiles and frowns. She converted 38 major topics and 44 minor ones, and her retail raw was $24,050. She felt sure that this would be noticed and appreciated by Bailey, whose concentration on party rank was the most acute of the three wise men. At 5:45, a voice called her name. She looked up to see a figure at the door, someone new, a man of about 30. She met him at the door.
May Holland?
Yes?
I'm Dante Peterson. I work with Eamon, and he's asked me to bring you up to his office. You ready?
They took the same route May had taken with Annie, and along the way, May realized that Dante didn't know May had been to Bailey's office before. Annie had never sworn her to secrecy, but the fact that Dante didn't know indicated that Bailey didn't know, and that she shouldn't reveal this herself. As they entered the long crimson hallway, May was sweating heavily. She could feel rivulets making their way from her armpits to her waist. She couldn't feel her feet.
"Here's a funny portrait of the three wise men," Dante said as they stopped at the door. "Bailey's niece did it."
May pretended to be surprised by it, delighted by its innocence and crude insight. Dante took the large gargoyle knocker and rapped the door. It opened, and Bailey's smiling face filled the void.
"Hello," he said. "Hi, Dante. Hi, May."
He smiled wider, acknowledging his rhyme.
"Come in."
He was wearing khakis and a white button-down, looking freshly showered. May followed him as he took in the room, scratching the nape of his neck as if almost embarrassed by how well he'd done here.
"So this is my favorite room. Very few people have seen it, not like I'm super secret about it or anything, but time just doesn't allow me to give tours and such. Have you seen anything like this before?"
May wanted to say, but couldn't, that she had seen this very room before.
"Not remotely," she said.
Something happened in Bailey's face at that moment, some twitch that seemed to bring the left corner of his eye and the left side of his mouth closer together.
"Thank you, Dante,"
Bailey said. Dante smiled and left, closing the heavy door behind him.
"So, May, tea?"
Bailey was standing before an antique tea set, a silver pot emitting a narrow corkscrew of steam.
"Sure," she said. "Green? Black?"
he asked, smiling.
"Gray?"
"Green, thanks, but you don't have to." Bailey was busy with the preparations.
"You've known our beloved Annie a long time?"
he asked, pouring carefully.
"I have, since sophomore year in college. 5 years now."
5 years? That's what, 30% of your life?" May knew he was rounding up a bit, but she emitted a tiny laugh.
"I guess so. A long time."
He handed her a saucer and cup and gestured for her to sit down. There were two chairs, both leather and overstuffed. Bailey dropped himself into his chair with a loud sigh and rested his ankle on his knee.
"Well, Annie is very important to us here, and Thus, you are, too. She talks about you like you could end up being very valuable to this community. Do you believe that's true? That I could be valuable here? He nodded, then blew on his tea. He looked over his teacup to her, his eyes steady. She met his gaze, then, briefly overwhelmed, she looked away, only to find his face again, this time in a framed photo on a nearby shelf. It was a formal portrait of Bailey's family in black and white, his three girls standing around their mother and Bailey, who were both sitting. Bailey's son was on his lap, wearing a tracksuit and holding an Iron Man action figure.
"Well, I hope so," May said. "I've been trying as hard as I can. I love the circle and can't express how much I appreciate the opportunity I've been given here."
Bailey smiled. "Good. Good. So tell me, how are you feeling about what happened last night?" He asked the question as if genuinely curious, as if her answer might go in any number of directions. May was on firm ground now. No obfuscation was necessary.
"Terrible," she said. "I barely slept. I'm so ashamed I want to puke."
She wouldn't have used the word when talking to Stenton, but she felt Bailey might appreciate the coarseness. He smiled almost imperceptibly and moved on. "May, let me ask you a question. Would you have behaved differently if you'd known about the sea change cameras at the marina?"
"Yes."
Bailey nodded emphatically.
"Okay. How?"
"I wouldn't have done what I did."
"And why not?"
"Because I would have been caught." Bailey tilted his head.
"Is that all?"
"Well, I wouldn't want anyone seeing me do that. It wasn't right. It's embarrassing." He put his cup on the table next to him and rested his hands on his lap, his palms in a gentle embrace.
"So in general, would you say you behave differently when you know you're being watched?"
"Sure, of course."
"And when you'll be held accountable?"
"Yes."
"And when there will be a historical record, that is, when or if your behavior will be permanently accessible, that a video of your behavior, for example, will exist forever?"
"Yes."
"Good. And do you remember my talk from earlier in the summer about the ultimate goal of sea change?"
"I know it would eliminate most crime if there was full saturation."
Bailey seemed pleased.
"Right. Correct. Everyday citizens like Gary Katz and Walt Lefebvre in this instance, because they took the time to set up their cameras, they helped keep us all safe. The crime was minor in this case, and there were no victims, thank God. You're alive. Marion's business and the kayaking industry generally lives to see another day. But one night of selfishness from you could have risked it all. The individual act has reverberations that can be nearly endless. Do you agree?"
"I do. I know, it's unconscionable."
And here May again had the feeling that she was a very short-sighted person who repeatedly jeopardized all she'd been given by the circle.
"Mr. Bailey, I can't believe I did this, and I know you're wondering if I fit in here. I just want you to know how much I value my position here and your faith in me, and I want to honor that. I'll do anything to make this up to you. Seriously, I'll take on any extra work. I'll do anything. Just tell me."
Bailey's face broke into a highly amused grin.
"May, your job isn't in jeopardy. You're here for good. Annie's here for good. Sorry if you believed otherwise, for even a second. We don't want either of you to ever leave."
"That's very good to hear. Thank you," May said, though her heart was hammering harder now. He smiled, nodding, as if happy and relieved to have all that settled.
"But this whole episode gives us a very important teachable moment, don't you think?"
The question seemed rhetorical, but May nodded anyway.
"May," he said, "when is a secret a good thing?"
May took a few seconds on this.
"When it can protect someone's feelings?
For example?"
"Well," she fumbled, "let's say you know your friend's boyfriend is cheating on her, but..."
"But what? You don't tell your friend?"
"Okay, that's not a good example. May, are you ever happy when a friend keeps a secret from you?"
May thought about the many small lies she told to Annie recently. Lies that she not only spoken, but typed. Lies made permanent and undeniable.
"No," but I understand when they have to.
That's interesting. Can you think of a time when you were happy one of your friends kept something from you?
May could not.
Not at the moment.
She felt sick.
Okay, Bailey said. For now, we can't think of good secrets between friends. Let's move on to families. In a family, is a secret a good thing? Theoretically, do you ever think, you know what would be great to keep from my family? A secret.
May thought of the many things her parents were likely keeping from her, the various indignities her father's illness caused them.
No, she said.
No secrets within a family?
Actually, May said, I don't know. There are definitely things you don't want your parents to know.
Would your parents want to know these things?
Maybe.
So you're depriving your parents of something they want. This is good?
No, but maybe better for all.
Better for you. Better for the keeper of the secret. Some dark secret is better kept from the parents. Is this a secret about some wonderful thing you've done? Perhaps knowing about it would bring just too much joy to your parents?
May laughed.
No. Clearly a secret is something you don't want them to know about because you're ashamed or you want to spare them from knowing you screwed up.
But we agree they would like to know.
Yes.
And are they entitled to know?
I guess.
Okay. So can we agree that we're talking about a situation where, in a perfect world, you're not doing anything you'd be ashamed of telling your parents?
Sure, but there are other things they might not understand.
Because they were never sons or daughters themselves?
No, but, May, do you have any gay relatives or friends?
Sure.
Do you know how different the world was for gays before and after people began coming out?
I have an idea of it.
Bailey stood and attended to the tea set. He poured more for himself and for May and sat down again.
I don't know if you do.
I was from the generation that struggled greatly with coming out. My brother is gay, and he was 24 before he admitted it to my family, and until then, it nearly killed him. It was a tumor festering inside him, and it was growing every day. But why did he think it would be better kept inside? When he told our parents, they barely blinked. He had created all this drama in his mind, all this mystery and weight around his big secret, and part of the problem, historically, was with other people keeping similar things secret. Coming out was so difficult until millions of other men and women came out. Then it got a lot easier, don't you agree? When millions of men and women came out of the closet, it made homosexuality not some mysterious so-called deviance, but a mainstream life path. You follow?
Yes, but... And I would argue that any place in the world where gays are still persecuted, you could instantly achieve great progress if all the gays and lesbians came out publicly at once. Then whoever is persecuting them, and all those who tacitly support this persecution, would realize that to persecute them would mean persecuting at least 10% of the population, including their sons, daughters, neighbors, and friends, even their own parents. It would be instantly untenable. But the persecution of gays or any minority group is made uniquely possible through secrecy.
Okay, I hadn't thought of it that way.
That's fine, he said, satisfied, and sipped his tea.
He ran his finger over his upper lip, drying it.
So we've explored the damage of secrets within the family and between friends, and the role of secrecy in persecuting large classes of people. Let's keep on our quest to find a use for a policy of secrecy. Should we look into politics?